Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of February. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of the interesting talk that we had with Christy Lawson from Wild Birds Unlimited up in Gardner, which was recorded a few weeks ago. If you want to hear part one of the show, please look for it as a podcast on kptz.org. I'm also very pleased to have sound engineer Charlie Fleischman here with me today to help share observations and events. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Deborah.
But before we get to that, let's first hear the mystery sounds of the week. You will note that I said sounds, plural. This week we have two different species calls for you to listen to. These closely related birds are often difficult to tell apart visually, so it will help you to ID them if you also learn their calls. We'll play them again at the end of the program and tell you what they are. The most notable event of the past week was, of course, hearing if Phil, the head groundhog authority out of Pennsylvania, saw his shadow on the 2nd of February. He did, forecasting six more weeks of winter. But Dr. Cliff Mass disagrees with him. Cliff is our meteorological authority out of the UW and says that, regardless of what Phil forecasted, or regardless of the weather that the Olympic Peninsula is in the grips of this week, winter in our area tends to peter out by the last week of February. I was happy to have the hope of spring become a bit more real a few days ago, when I saw the first flash of a magenta flower peeping out from a fat salmonberry bud.
In other news, findings from a new study out this month in the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Science point to yet more trouble ahead for our southern resident killer whale population. The Kitsap Sun reports that the study has found that seal and sea lions are taking a major bite out of the threatened Chinook salmon population in Puget Sound, and the competition for food could be having negative repercussions on our endangered orca.
The populations of seals and sea lions have bounced back in our area, with the Salish Sea today believed to have one of the highest densities of harbor seals any place in the world. Seals and sea lions are estimated to be eating about 1.4 million pounds of Puget Sound Chinook each year, about nine times more than they were eating in 1970. To further complicate matters, it appears that seals and sea lions are consuming significant numbers of juvenile salmon compared to the adult salmon consumed by orca and humans. If it can be shown that competition for food is impacting the recovery of southern resident killer whales, balancing the population of fish and marine mammals could become a major issue.
We have previously mentioned on Nature Now that non-native holly berries are a popular food source for some of our birds in the wintertime. Holly berries contain saponins along with theobromine, an alkaloid that is related to caffeine and found in chocolate and known to be toxic in enough quantity. If a child or a dog eats a couple of berries, it is unlikely to cause a problem, but 20 berries could prove to be fatal. So how is it that the birds are able to digest them?
Research suggests that berries lose some of their toxicity after the first frost, which is when the birds tend to feed on them. A complicating factor is that the berries also start to ferment after the first frost, resulting in increased alcohol content, and it is possible for the birds to become intoxicated from ingesting too many berries. The relatively large livers of waxwings and other fruit-eating birds are thought to help the birds handle the additional alcohol.
Our friend Jeff Hammerson wrote in to tell us about a fascinating re-sighting of a color-banded black brant goose at Point Hudson. Banding data for this bird indicates that it hatched on Banks Island, Canada, in 1991 or earlier, so it is at least 25.5 years old. This is the fourth year that he's seen and photographed it in our area in the winter.
Those are the advantages of banding studies. You'd never know that except for the fact that they banded these birds. So it's really cool information to get. He also sent along a really cool video clip that he took of a large group of horned grebes diving in synchrony down in Port Ludlow Bay. Horned grebes are one of several species of grebe that we get here, and they are common residents in our area in the wintertime, especially on saltwater bays and inlets. But I had never seen them fishing in synchrony before watching this clip. First one, then two, then five, then 20 disappeared, until within a few moments the whole bird party had disappeared. About half a minute later, they reappeared, as if by magic, the same way, until all 75 or so of them were back bobbing on the surface again. Then the whole performance was repeated about 20 seconds later. They are likely feeding on schools of small fish swimming below them.
Lastly, there was a very interesting posting on Tweeters a few days ago, especially interesting given that our show focuses on falcons this week. Cindy Willis of Whidbey Island reported seeing four species of falcon on the 1st of February while birding on the Samish Flats. First, she had a rare sighting of a prairie falcon, next a merlin perched on a power line, then three female American kestrels, and ending with three peregrine falcons. One of the peregrines looked like a juvenile, the second, a male, was stooping on a dunlin, with a female flying in to join him. This area is usually a great place to view raptors in the wintertime.
Last month, we had so many interesting things to discuss about hawks with our guest Christy Lawson of Wild Birds Unlimited that we ran out of time. This week, we continue with part two of our recorded conversation. Probably the most commonly seen hawk is the red-tailed hawk, which is probably the most commonly seen, most widely distributed hawk in North America, right?
Red-tailed hawks are one of the most common hawks that we see. Now, especially because a lot of them are sitting in bare trees looking for prey, and they're very easy to spot. Really, if you are taking the time to look, you can spot one almost anywhere. They sit on fence posts. They sit on telephone poles. They sit in trees and on open field edges. Red-tailed hawks are highly adaptive birds, and they can live almost anywhere in the United States. They like to soar above open fields, slowly turning in circles on their broad, round wings. Other times you'll see them atop telephone poles, eyes fixed on the ground, ready to catch the movements of a vole or a rabbit. These birds, they attack in a slow, controlled dive with their legs outstretched, which is very different from the hunting methods of the accipiters.
Uh-huh. But even though they're really easy to spot, people often think that they're seeing a different species of bird because the plumage is so variable, right?
There are regional differences in red-tailed hawks. Very extremely variable plumage, and some of this variation is regional. There is a Great Plains race of red-tailed hawk called a Kreider's hawk, which is pale with a whitish head and has almost a washed-out pink in the tail. There are light morph species as well, western birds that tend to be streakier on the underparts than the eastern red-tails. We have dark morph red-tailed hawks, too, that can occur almost anywhere, but are more common in western North America, particularly in Alaska and northwest Canada, where they have an all-dark red-tailed hawk called a Harlan's hawk.
But what seems to remain constant is that it's the red tail in the adults. And if you can just get a good look at the overside of the feathers when it's perched and circling, it's really clearly rusty red.
Definitely.
Colored.
And I feel like there's nothing really any more beautiful than sunlight shining through a flying red-tailed hawk's tail. I think it's amazing. I love to see that from underneath. Sunlight shining through it is absolutely beautiful.
Don't we also get a bunch of migrants here in the wintertime?
There is some southern migration in the red-tailed species. I think that it happens more in the populations from the areas where the snowpack gets deep. These birds prey mainly on rodents. If those rodents are burrowing under the snow, it makes it very tough for them to find food. So I think that when the snowpack gets deep in areas where these birds are living, they tend to head south.
But speaking of migration, how much of a factor is it with our Olympic Peninsula hawks in general?
I think in general, we don't see a whole lot of migration with our resident birds here. We have pretty mild winters. We have abundant food for them, especially this year, it seems like. And
yeah, we were talking about earlier how there's so many moles, but that it also
carries
follows
over
into other rodents
too.
Yeah.
Yes. So there's lots of those, which means that it's a big rodent year, which means it's a big raptor year as well,
yeah,
which is good.
And probably that's because we didn't have a drought this summer, right?
Yep,
and we
definitely had
lots of berries, and it just made for a lot of food for everybody.
Definitely. The Olympic Peninsula is part of the Pacific Flyway, which is the major north-south flyway for the migratory birds in America. It extends from Alaska to Patagonia. And every year, migratory birds travel some or all of this distance, both in the spring and fall, following food sources and heading to breeding grounds. The northern Pacific coast sees a major migration route for northern harriers and sharp-shinned hawks heading south from northern BC and Alaska. More than 1,000 birds are reported annually just in our northern Pacific coast. We also see a large number of migrating turkey vultures from the BC area, and on eruptive years, we get snowy owls here as well. Scarcity of food is the primary reason that most North American hawks leave their breeding territories in winter. Overall, they say about 45% of all raptor populations migrate.
But those on the Olympic Peninsula are pretty steady.
Our numbers are pretty constant.
Yeah. And if we were to view migration, we would probably be like going to Nia Bay.
Nia Bay is a fantastic place to go out and bird. It is sort of the first place that they hit off the Straits of Juan de Fuca if they're coming across. And so they get a lot of birds landing and resting. And we see some very interesting species out there.
In both the spring and the fall.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So what about rough-legged hawks?
Rough-legged hawks breed in the tundra, and they migrate south in the winters. They do show up here in November, from like the time between November to March, along the Pacific Trough, which is our coastline that starts right about from about PA and runs east down the Hood Canal Corridor. The name rough-legged hawk is kind of cool. It refers to the feathers on their legs. Rough-legged hawks and the ferruginous hawks and the golden eagles are the only American raptors to have leg feathers all the way down to their toes. So that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
And now on to some people's favorites, birds that used to be called hawks but now are more properly called falcons. What about the sparrow, duck, fish, and pigeon hawks?
Well, we have three pretty common falcons here in our area. We get peregrines, merlins, and kestrels. Falcons are really a different breed of birds. They're streamlined birds with sharply pointed wings. They're built for speeds and maneuverability. Peregrine falcons have been clocked at diving at speeds of right around 200 miles per hour.
Wow.
These falcons have a really distinct rowing beat to their flight, and some are known to be able to stall in the air and hover above their prey. I actually saw a kestrel on the way into Squim the other day, right in the field across the highway from the Welcome to Squim sign. He was stalled right perfectly in the air with sunlight like beaming down on him.
Cool.
It was gorgeous.
I've been seeing more kestrels lately. I'm hoping that that's not just a fluke, that they really are coming back.
Numbers are going up for these birds. So the falcons, they also have a very distinct stripe below their eye called a malar stripe. And one of the coolest things, I think, between the hawks and the falcons is that falcons kill with their beaks. They use a tooth on the side of their beak instead of their feet or their talons to kill their prey.
Uh-huh. And you can actually see that if you are lucky enough to see them sitting. You can get your binocs on it. It's really a very distinctive notch that they've
got.
We also get a couple of other falcons in our area, right? But
Yes. They're
so rare that you have to be really, really lucky to see them.
Definitely. So we get the jeer falcons. More in eastern Washington, we get the prairie falcons. Jeer falcons are the largest falcons in the world. They are predators of the high Arctic, where they feed primarily on ptarmigans, plummet from the sky to strike prey on the ground. These guys nest in remote cliffs in the far reaches of Canada and Alaska. They tend not to have too much problem or too much interference with human activity because they nest in such remote areas, but they do face challenges with climate change. They're very rare visitors to the open habitats in the northern United States, but occasionally they do show up.
And rare visitors for us, too.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think I've ever seen one, and I have longed to see one.
Definitely. They're on my list of I need to see one of those birds, too.
And they do come into our more open areas sometimes, like the Dungeness Spit.
Yep.
And probably around the prairies of Fort Worden there along the coast, you probably, if you were really lucky.
It seems like a good habitat for them, definitely.
Yeah.
The prairie falcons are raptors of the West's wide open spaces, including eastern Washington. Prairie falcons, they glide above shrubby deserts and grasslands, searching for squirrels and other small mammals and birds. The prairie falcons have a really interesting, like, dark triangle, like, in their armpit feathers that kind of help distinguish it from other falcons. They like the big, wide open habitat of sagebrush, deserts, prairie, agricultural fields, alpine meadows. And they will go up into habitats of 11,000 feet. So they're adapted to higher elevation, too. They like to nest on the ledges of sheer rocky cliffs. And they can be hard to spot, too, because they blend in almost perfectly with steep bluffs and cliffs where they nest.
Uh-huh.
They're very well camouflaged.
I thought that I might have seen a prairie falcon over on Whidbey Island last year, but I wasn't sure. I didn't get a very good view. I mean, that's the beauty of looking for birds, is that you get these little teases. I mean, it's both...
piques your interest.
I know. It's both wonderful and frustrating because you're like, oh, was that? Was that really that? And speaking of rare sightings, a friend of mine at North Beach saw a white-tailed kite a couple of times last year. Did you have any sightings of these in the Sequim area?
I heard about the report in Port Townsend here, but I didn't personally hear any more reports on the peninsula. But I did do a little digging on eBird, which is a great resource to see where birds are at in our area.
Uh-huh.
And I saw that there was a report in the Port Angeles area of a white-tailed kite as well. Probably our same one. Probably
moving around. Yeah, because they probably have pretty large home range sizes.
I think so. You know, the kites are so, so beautiful. They have very distinct forked tails. And the white kites are found primarily throughout Southern California in grassland, open country area, farmlands, river valleys, foothills, areas like that. It's a resident on the coast and in the interior of California. And it's also found in Arizona, Southern Texas, and in the tropics. But occasionally we do get to see one up here too.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, we could go on and on about all the cool raptors that we have on the peninsula and the amazing visitors that drift in, but we have run out of time. So thanks so much for joining us, Christy.
Thank you for having me again.
And we hope to have you back on our program again soon.
It would be my pleasure.
Thank you.
We have a slew of upcoming natural history events to tell you about, but they are all occurring next Saturday, February 11th, so you have some difficult choices ahead. The event closest to home is a work party planned by the Jefferson Land Trust, intended to improve the Port Townsend Gateway Preserve, a scenic greenbelt leading into Port Townsend along the Larry Scott Trail. Go to saveland.org for details.
Next is a field trip sponsored by the Admiralty Audubon Society to look for birds around the Fort Casey area. Meet on the main passenger deck for the 9:30 sailing from Port Townsend to Whidbey Island, and go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more information.
But you hit the jackpot when you travel west to events organized with the Olympic Audubon Society based in Sequim, with no less than three events to choose from on Saturday. First, there is an all-day oiled wildlife haswapper training class up in Port Angeles, at the same time as there is a class on nesting scheduled at the Dungeness River Audubon Center near Sequim, which overlaps with a field trip to Pitcher Pocket in Sequim Bay that same morning. Go to OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for all of the details. You must be pre-registered to attend the haswapper training, and it should be done ASAP. If you miss this opportunity, there's another training offered in Everett on March 18th.
And here's our mystery sound again. The first call that we played for you is a sharp-shinned hawk's alarm call, and the second is that of its cousin, the Cooper's hawk. Do you notice how much bigger the call sounds from the Cooper's hawk? This is because the Cooper's hawk generally is a bigger bird than a sharpie. But as we discussed in part one of our show on hawks, this doesn't always hold true. This is due to the difference in size between the sexes in raptors, with the females generally up to 25% larger in size than the males. This means that there is some size overlap between a female sharp-shinned hawk and a male Cooper's hawk. And since the species and the sexes look very similar, this can lead to confusion and identification. Listening for the call will help with distinguishing between the species, but also pay special attention to their legs and tail. Sharpies have long, matchstick-thin yellow legs and a shorter, squared-off tail, while Coopers have yellow legs that appear shorter and more stout, with a longer, more rounded tail with broad bands on it. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of February. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music this week is Peregrine, performed by Alderwick.
Swoop among the pines, dip towards the ground. Seek your own prey, bellow a screeching sound. Bellow a screeching sound. Call of the wild is carried on the wind. Send your regards to the aged peregrine. He grants all your wishes, flies through your dreams in a matter of moments. You'll forget what you've seen. A bird of myth, a beast among legends. He dives and he swoops with impeccable precision.